The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart.
I don't want an election. The public don't want an election. The country doesn't want an election. But this House has left no other option than letting the public decide.
The offer of the election today is a bit like the offer of an apple to Snow White and the Wicked Queen, because what he's offering is not an apple or even an election, but the poison of a no deal.
Boris Johnson ran for his party's leadership with the slogan "Deliver Brexit by 31st of October, unite the party, defeat Jeremy Corbyn and energise our country." How's that going for him? MPs returned to Westminster after their summer break this week and they were furious. With just days to go before Johnson plans to suspend Parliament, they wasted no time in inflicting a string of defeats on the new Prime Minister in a bid to block a no-deal Brexit. Forcing a showdown with the wreckers in Parliament has long been part of Johnson's plan to leave the EU by the 31st of October, do or die. But it's an extraordinary gamble. With 21 rebel Tory MPs booted out of the party, the potential loss of most Tory seats in Scotland, and Jeremy Corbyn so far refusing an early election, could Johnson's premiership last just months? Also this week, new Chancellor Sajid Javid's spending review comes under the spotlight, and we talk to polling wizard John Curtis about whether a snap general election is really a good idea. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, this week saw our new Prime Minister lose his first parliamentary vote and his governing majority on the same day, and saw some of the best-known Tory figures in Parliament kicked out of their party. In the early hours of this morning, the government agreed to let a bill aimed at blocking a no-deal Brexit pass through the House of Lords by the end of Friday and back to the House of Commons, after Jeremy Corbyn said he would be prepared to support an election once that piece of legislation has got royal assent. So Johnson has been repeatedly humiliated in just 3 days in the Commons. Is it as bad as it looks, or is this all part of Dominic Cummings' cunning plan? Well, I'm joined to discuss all that by Jonathan Friedland and Zoe Williams from The Guardian, and Theresa May's former press secretary, Paul Harrison. Hello all.
Hi there.
Hi.
Paul, I feel like we should start with you. You've been inside Downing Street on these sort of extraordinary days, as we've seen in the past couple of days, parliamentary defeats, you know, trying to work out what the next tactical step is. What does that feel like?
It's a very high-pressure environment, and we are living through the most extraordinary times I imagine any of us can remember politically. It's a bit like that ancient proverb, you know, may you live in interesting times, but that, I think, it was originally intended as a curse. it's very, very high pressure, and you're forced to confront a series of decisions that are essentially often what is the least worst option that I have available here. It comes down to that. And to try to, you know, after every defeat, you know, we had a few of them, I had to usually go and do a briefing to people like you, Heather, and say, what is the plan next? What is the government going to do next? And it's always that sense of trying to explain what your strategy is, what you're going to do, and, you know, why it is worth sticking with you.
And does it feel a bit as though he's confronting the same choices in some ways, right? He's got a hung parliament, he wants to get on with Brexit. He's just sort of going about it in a more aggressive way, and he's like sort of Theresa May with a battering ram.
That may very well be the strategy. There are certain realities that have to be confronted in that, you know, the governing party no longer has a majority. We came pretty close to that being the case for us when I was working in Downing Street. The government of the day under David Cameron set the country a question about our relationship with the European Union. The country answered it. Parliament hasn't found a way to actually deliver on what the country said. And, you know, that's all quite existential stuff, frankly. But I think the number of choices as time elapses diminishes and, you know, the horizon narrows. And I think that is what we're seeing play out.
And Johnny, it feels like we're going to end up at the polls quite soon, doesn't it? Was that always how this confrontation was going to have to end?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be fascinated to hear what Paul thinks about the extent to which it is a cunning plan or it's day-to-day ad hoc kind of improvisation. But to the extent there was a plan, I think it was to force this into a showdown and to make it an electoral showdown. And I think that was what was going on with the prorogation decision. That felt strategic to me. It was a lot, you know, they'd had time, in fact, subject of a court case, how much time? They had to decide that and think about it. The other stuff has felt much more spasmodic. And, you know, I'm not sure they really wanted, headlines about, you know, Winston Churchill's grandson being booted out of the Conservative Party, I guess they thought that the 21 expellees, you know, 18 of them would fold under that threat and only two or three people would have to be kicked out. So some of that has felt sort of ad hoc and ad-libbed. But the underlying strategy, I think, was to force this to a confrontation and an election that he, Boris Johnson, Cummings at his side, thought he could win. And so now I think we're only into an argument about exactly when, you know, which side of the October-November dividing line it's going to fall. Will it be before the Brexit, you know, crash out date of the 31st or just after? And that's the battle that's going on, actually involving decisions on the opposition side now, inside SNP headquarters, Labour headquarters, etc. But you know, yeah, there's going to be an election. It's not an if, it's now a when. And that, I think, was always the game plan.
And Zoe, Labour has had to try to work quite hard this week not to be kind of wrong-footed, hasn't it, by this challenge that Johnson has sort of thrown down about, you know, how and whether and when we have a general election.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I kind of love about this, is that Dominic Cummings thinks he's playing four-dimensional chess, and he thinks if you plan it well enough, you can tell exactly what the outcome is. But what he's forgotten is that all the chess pieces also have their own personalities. So it's kind of dry brain meets wet brain, and wet brain is winning. I mean, you know, and wet brain carries the narrative because everybody can see personalities where they can't see the, you know, the inside of Dominic Cummings is 4D chess, which, you know, even if it is as intelligent as he likes to say it is, which I don't believe anyway. The decisions for Labour now are, you know, whether or not, and it's not entirely in their gift, but just today they are setting the timeline, and their decision is, do they go for an election before the 17th or do they go for an election after the 31st? Now, obviously, they're holding together a very fragile alliance of their own with the Remain alliance. And so a delay doesn't suit them that well. But on the other hand, a number of things do suit them. Firstly, if they do push it longer, they'll get a load of student registrations, which will entirely play in their favour. They will have more time to prepare, and Southside is not ready.
Labour HQ.
Yeah, nobody thinks Labour HQ is ready, not even Labour HQ. Thirdly, the kind of hypothetical polls are incredibly difficult to frame and very hard to kind of infer much from, but the hypothetical polling that has been done show that Boris's ratings really go off a cliff if the election's after the 31st of October, because he's already failed in his fundamental promise. So those three things really suggest that a November election will be better for Labour than a October election. Obviously, they're selling that as, we want to get this legislation, i.e. the no deal legislation, completely nailed down before we go into anything, because once we're in an election period, Parliament no longer has any power. And that's actually quite a good line. That's not a bad line at all.
Yeah. I mean, some of the briefing's been a bit confusing from the Labour side, I think, looking now on from the outside, but it seems, rather than having Seamus Milne sort of look behind me when I used to do my briefings, because the government always used to go first, but it seems like there is a division about whether you actually have the extension secured at council, or whether it's enough to say that this bill that has gone through the House of Commons now is going to go through the House of Lords quite shortly, because it seems that there's been a truce agreed at 1:30 this morning. Which of those two becomes the arbiter of when you...
The word coming out of the EU now is that the minute the bill has passed, they will wave through an extension, irrespective of whether Boris arrives with a letter.
Well, in which case, Labour's got no reason not to go to the polls.
And I think there's been some pushback of that, because people say, yeah, they might do that, but it's got to have a signature from the UK government at the bottom. That's all...
But unbelievably, people are saying, what if Johnson went to Orban and got him
to veto it?
people I know, everybody... Sorry, for the listener, Heather just made a face like... Absolutely no way.
I mean, we should say Boris Johnson has said very clearly, or certainly his spokespeople have said very clearly, we're not going to do this. You can pass this law, but Boris Johnson's the Prime Minister. He's not going to go to Brussels.
No,
he's not going to ask for an extension.
And then the nerds get very busy with, well, what do you do in that situation? And that is quite a fascinating sort of drama, where you could imagine a Boris Johnson just sitting, squatting in number 10, refusing to obey the command of the House of Commons, and the House of Commons having to resort to extraordinary measures to get its will done. There is a member of the Shadow Cabinet who has had drafted a small bill that mandates the Speaker to go to Brussels and act as the representative of a sovereign
parliament.
You see,
at that point, isn't Labour subject to the claim that they're part of a kind of establishment Westminster bloc?
Absolutely, all
that
of
is
this
trying
stuff.
To delay a thing that the and people that, have voted
and
for.
And that's why you think maybe there is a plan, that Cummings likes the idea of them, the Remainer Parliament, looking tricksy and, you know, saboteurs of the people's will. So they don't necessarily mind that. The one thing I would say, in agreement with what Zoe was saying about the going long thing, you know, there is this argument, is it worse to be seen as a chicken who doesn't want the election? That's one option for Jeremy
the
Corbyn.
The most dangerous chicken in Britain, the
you
Sun
know,
had it this morning.
Slightly mixed message, I know.
That bit about Wallace and Gromit poster. Have you seen this chicken?
Oh, that's what it was like. I was thinking Drop the Dead Donkey in a very dated reference, but you're right, it's Wallace and Gromit.
Chicken
the dangerous chicken. The dangerous chicken is very fun. But, you know, is that so damaging to Jeremy Corbyn that he seems as if he's frightened of a fight? On the other hand, I think there's some merit in Labour's argument, or even just electoral punch in Labour saying, look, we would go for an election. It's just the trouble is this man, Boris Johnson, is so untrustworthy. And he's himself is tricksy. And we know he breaks all the conventions and all the norms. So he might agree to a date that's fine and then change it and have the
election date.
Yeah, he could put the election date just after an EU crash out on November the 1st. And then suddenly we've crashed out with no deal and we've got, as Zoe was saying, no tools left because Parliament's no longer sitting because it's in the middle of a campaign. Making the focus of the discussion the unique untrustworthiness of Boris Johnson is not so bad for Labour. You know, part of the argument is that Paul's former boss, Theresa May, well, if she had said it, you could trust that. But, you know, they wouldn't have said that at the time. But now that she's a former Prime Minister, they can say that. It's something uniquely mendacious and dishonest about Boris Johnson. And I think that lands because people have seen with their own eyes, you know, even just in the last few days, that Boris Johnson is not straight and honest. And therefore, I think that's not a bad softening up before an election campaign. But I see all the arguments about chicken and delay and you know, maybe those will prevail.
Paul, what would you be advising Jeremy Corbyn to do at this point?
Well, I'd probably
be... and tendering
your resignation. It'd be hard to imagine, possibly.
We'd both be surprised to be there. I think, look, it's one of those words that only people in Westminster use, which is perhaps part of the problem. But the frit thing is obviously contentious for leader of the opposition.
My Scottish granny used to use it. I'll just say that.
Oh, there
Scottish
we go. You know, it's not a good look for the leader of the opposition to not be looking for an election when the fact is that, you know, he's been calling for one for 2 years. So, you know, but there is a big strategic question. It's very hard to game how all this stuff plays out, partly because not everyone is a rational actor. You know, people are responding emotionally as well as responding logically to political problems as they occur. But there's a big strategic question about, you know, at what point and what guarantees you seek that the Labour Party support an election. And, you know, do you go along with, for the sake of expediency, a quick one, which will be who do you want sitting around the council table on the 18th of October? We kind of tried that in 2017. But
it didn't go well, that, did it?
It was not perfect. But, you know, do you do that or do you try and play it a bit longer? The sort of... I understand all of Zoe's arguments. I think they're well made. I suppose the counter to some of the ideas about playing for time, which I suppose is what it is that, you know, the government are today saying the election campaign starts now. So they're pushing a message about 20,000 more police officers. Yeah. You know, yesterday we saw the end of austerity, which is something the PM signalled in the conference speech that I worked on that went right. And
the
ex-PM, you know,
yeah.
Sorry, force of habit. But yeah, to be honest, that's a circle that I haven't yet been able to square in my own mind.
The other thing I would say about the Tories being on an election footing already and so Labour being on dangerous territory by playing for time, the weird thing is Boris Johnson, he's becoming very angry and splenetic and irascible and grumpy, and it doesn't work well at all with his offer, which is buffoony and cheerful and optimistic and can-do attitude. And I think, actually, the longer they have bad-tempered Boris on the national stage, the better it will be.
It's interesting. He reminds me a bit of Jeremy Corbyn, maybe at an earlier stage, where you felt that he was really, really happy out on the campaign trail, meeting people, having pictures taken with people's dogs and signing things, and quite uncomfortable and almost sort of peevish.
Yes.
In the chamber, yeah, in the House of Commons. And actually, Boris Johnson has a particular irritability when confronted by an absolute sea of Labour MPs who really loathe him, I think, in a way that they didn't really loathe Theresa May. Yeah, they didn't like what she stood for, but they didn't hate her. They hate Boris Johnson.
And actually, because he's so avoidant of press coverage, the press is left scrutinising very closely how he behaves in the Commons, and he behaves like a thug in the Commons.
But maybe that'll all be forgotten. Let's talk a bit about the framing of the campaign. So there'll be a lot of thinking going on, won't there, about how to frame this campaign in the message, and as you say, we can see bits of it in the spending review. So he's sort of shut the door on austerity, forget that, chuck that out the window. Lots of money for things that we know, presumably the polling shows you, people are particularly concerned about, the NHS at schools, and so on. How will he frame, do you think, the Brexit issue? How does he do that? How does that work?
I mean, I think there's lots of evidence, private polling and public, and I think how frankly we all feel that people want to see a resolution to the Brexit debate one way or the other. There is a little bit of we're all really tired of this, and you know, bringing it to a head actually I'm sure has a certain amount of electoral appeal. And if I can just sort of veer off for a very quick anecdote, when one budget there was a specific measure which the then Chancellor, no longer Tory,
the then Tory MP,
had specifically targeted to help working mums, and it was a reasonable amount of money, and so we did some focus group work and some private polling to try and see whether that had landed, and we found that one of the problems was that people were beginning to preemptively turn off TV news, particularly in the sort of age group we were going for, because they were worried that Brexit might come up.
That is brilliant.
So there's a certain amount of, you know,
I feel their pain, I have to say.
I can understand
that. You couldn't get messages through that wall of resistance to Brexit. I mean, I think that is the big appeal, the big case when you ask about framing. Get it done. Brexit will be over if you vote for me. I think that if that's a big case for Boris Johnson. Secondary to that is the democracy, the people's will has not yet been done, and I will do it. And the great virtue of both those is sheer simplicity, because the rebuttal for both just takes a sentence or two, whereas those you can capture in two or three words. That's very powerful.
Disagree as strongly as I possibly can. I think the message, I will stop talking about Brexit by stopping Brexit, is so much more simpler and more believable than I will take this thing which people before me who were just as intelligent haven't been able to do.
I would agree with that.
I'll get it over the line.
I was about to say, the only other people who can come close are the Dems with a revoke message. Anything which is less than revoke, by literally I will stop Brexit, means you're still talking.
Yeah, but Johnny,
about it,
so. I think Labour's going revoke. That's the other reason why kicking it a little bit further down the road is so good.
Revoke under Jeremy Corbyn.
Seriously, wait, stop looking at me like that, everybody.
I look like this all the time.
McDonald's already said he thinks revoke is a better idea. Now, but the blocks to revoke are Seamus and Len McCluskey. And
well, also, you know, John Trickett and some of those.
Even Trickett.
Ian Lavery.
Lavery, yes, but even Trickett.
And it would have been MPs like Gloria DiPiero and people in Leave
quite
seats.
Possible.
Can't
quite
imagine
possibly.
Gareth Snell's keen on revoke.
Look, even Trickett is coming round, and a lot of those people would be talked round by John Mack if he were given his head. So the blocks are within the opposition, the leader of the opposition's office, rather than the wider party. Because if they were going to listen to individual MPs, they would listen to the majority of individual MPs who want to revoke. But this is another reason why, just from my point of view, I really am into kicking it further down, is that if conference happens, then conference again gets a say. And conference, there was a kind of, 2 months ago, it was quite difficult to get CLPs to say they were bringing a Brexit motion, because a lot of them were saying, we're going to bring a Green New Deal motion, we want to just get past it. But actually, a lot of CLPs are now saying they're bringing a Brexit motion, and that Brexit motion, I think, is going to... I mean, I can see
that's the logical direction of travel. I just can't see them getting there before a manifesto is
I think the John McDonnell kind of actually saying the word revoke out loud was much more significant than it seemed.
Well, that would immediately deprive the Liberal Democrats of their USP in a campaign, which was, I was going to go on to say, was the clarity which could match the Boris Johnson one. I thought the polarity would be one side, Boris Johnson says, get it done, it's over, and then Joe Swinson can say that, and Labour was still going to be, like we saw Richard Bergen this week saying, we'll negotiate a deal, bring it back, we might vote against it, might vote for it. More complexity, more Brexit. If Zoe's right, it seems unlikely to me that the so-called Clause 5 group who write the manifesto would get to that point, partly because there's still a strong voice in the party of people, Labour MPs and others who represent seats that voted Leave, even though, you know, we would argue perhaps that the Labour voters in those seats tilt towards Remain. Eventually, as in, I'm sort of with Heather on this, I think eventually, and I'm thinking more years than months or weeks, a Keir Starmer-ish sort of Labour Party could be in a revoke place. I just don't see this Labour Party under this leadership being there any time near enough, even if it's a November election. But I'm heartened by Zoe's dispatches from the front, because if that's true, that's an intriguing and encouraging development.
I ought to have added the caveat that I'm a bit of a Boris Johnson myself, in the sense that what I say I think is going to happen is often what I want to happen.
So I did not expect to hear those words from your lips. I had to say,
in that one regard.
Can we talk a bit about the language in which this debate is being conducted? So, you know, Boris Johnson's repeatedly been calling this piece of legislation this week Jeremy Corbyn's surrender bill. He said it over and over again. This is the kind of language that you often hear if you sit in Parliament and you hear the sort of long-time leavers, so the Bill Cashes and the John Redwoods, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg to some extent. You often hear about vassalage and surrender and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's sort of slightly light-hearted from Johnson, but is it damaging? Is it ramping up the rhetoric? I mean, Paul, I can't imagine Theresa May using that kind of language.
I think the simplicity of communication, actually, for someone who's pretty articulate, is one of Boris's strengths. I mean, I didn't love Chuck Checkers, but, you know, two alliterative words, you know, a clear call to action. It is something that he's quite good at, I think, and that is a skill in modern politics that you need. It's a club that you have to have in your bag. I don't think surrender bill, personally, that doesn't feel particularly incendiary, particularly given some of the more incendiary things that have been said. You know, the way that motives are impugned on a very personal level has been one of the big failings of the whole Brexit debate, as far as I can tell. And there's an extent to which some voices that previously would have been marginalised on the extremes of both the left and the right of this debate, on the very pro-Remain side, the very pro-Leave side, has led to some pretty uncomfortable rhetoric. And I think that somehow we need a balm to soothe all of that, because it is not helping our national life one bit.
I'd love to know where that balm is coming from, because I agree with you, but I don't know.
It's an unsolved problem.
I didn't like the phrase at all, because it's not on its own, just the word on its own. It's more that it's part of a whole register of vocabulary that goes with the idea that this is a war with the European Union, an enemy. So it's the same language we've had about collaborators, surrender. I think your previous boss did go a bit close to it with, in the, and you know, I know these were both male headlines, but in that Enemies of the People, Crush the Saboteurs era, we were into that grammar.
It was a particular speech very early in the 2017 campaign, wasn't there?
Yes, there was a bit like that.
What I thought in listening to you say them is that I completely agree with you, Johnny, that it was that it does debase the public discourse and it's has a toxic effect. But when you were saying them, they do sound quite funny. Like, and that's they do carry their own risk, words like these, because they're so overheated and they're so excessive that they're very easy to mock. And I think probably they don't play to that. They might play to that absolutely outraged patriot core of like some pensioners, but I think,
well, and he wants to win back Brexit Party voters.
Yeah, but
right?
I think that language
appeals to him. It's also just a very it's a basic skill in politics, but one that, you know, is often neglected, which is to define things early so that the opponent doesn't. So the famous example is the estate tax in the United States that became the death tax, and that certainly turned what had been a winning proposition for Democrats into a losing proposition, because who's in favour of a death tax? And, you know, Labour did very well in 2017. Actually, I'm not sure who it was who did brand it the dementia tax. But once it was the dementia tax, there was no way out from under that for Theresa May. And so getting in early, and I thought surrender bill was crude and I didn't like the war register or lexicon. But I thought to myself, they've defined it and Labour hadn't yet given it a label.
I mean, I don't.
That's always a battle to be the one to define it first.
I no longer have, you know, quite the dog in this fight that I used to. But it's worth saying, I think, that just the way we talk about politics is actually, if you look at it, and always has been really martial. We use loads of warlike language, and we always have. And so, you know, maybe surrender is a bit of a continuation of that. I think, yeah, it's a smart characterization. Whether or not it works, you know, remains to be seen. It's hard, particularly through the heat of an election campaign, to know what messages will take off, and actually sometimes the ground that you're fighting on.
Well, this is a really interesting discussion about signal and noise. You know, there is a ton of noise out of Westminster, and the stuff we've all been following obsessively, and I think typified by, for example, that picture that was big on my Twitter timeline of Jacob Rees-Mogg lounging on the benches. Now, what's the signal that is getting out there? One of our colleagues has been speaking this morning about listening not to the Today programme, but to commercial radio, you know, music radio stations where you have 20 seconds of news every hour. And there, the only story apparently today was just Boris Johnson wants an early election, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't. Johnson has called Corbyn a coward for not doing it. That's the bit of a signal that got through. And I just wonder if the signal that is going to come out of all of this, which has felt to me like a terrible week for Boris Johnson. Could it be, in my bubble, that I'm wrong and the signal that's getting through is there's Boris Johnson, Tribune of the People, fighting for your Brexit and all these other tricky Parliament politicians?
Yeah, that's why I think Jeremy Corbyn's not going to be able to hold out very long against the general election. But we're, you know, we're also, back to where we started.
There's one more point, which is that the SNP might yet throw a spanner in Jeremy Corbyn's plans, because if Boris comes back with a bill for a general election, he doesn't need 2/3 of Parliament, he only needs a majority, and the SNP could
give him that majority.
And also that would have a date in it, right? So you which Parliament will be able to amend. So exactly. Labour's argument about, oh well, he's tricksy and he might move the date of the poll sort of falls away in those circumstances, it seems to me. Paul, how do you feel when you look at your party and think about all these sort of great figures that Nicholas Soames is, you know, as you say, the man who was Chancellor a few months ago, losing the whip and being... is that just... Johnson was always going to take a sort of more combative approach to this than Theresa May. You felt that they were sort of looking on while Theresa May was handling this and thinking, gosh, she's not being tough enough. She should really be, you know, sticking it to these people. But do you feel sad when you look at those people having the whip removed?
There are some people that I know pretty well in the group that were... that aren't Tory MPs anymore and that I work with quite closely. When I was first a researcher in the House of Commons some time ago now, David Gort was one of the people that I shared an office with. Very nice man. But, I mean, unfortunately, I think during the time that Theresa was in office, that 2 years that I worked with her, we tried to build consensus and to take people with us and to keep the party together. And I think there is an extent to which that approach, when the Conservative Party, like the Labour Party, like the public, is just fundamentally split on the issue. I don't think that sort of thing can hearten anybody who's chosen to work for a political party. But, you know, once the threat had been made, it's difficult not to carry it through, because otherwise you continue with, you know, authority even more diminished. But, you know,
Can it be put back together again? I mean, I remember, you know, sort of studying politics umpteen years ago, being told that the Tories were the kind of, they weren't terribly ideological, they were rather pragmatic, they were awfully good at hanging on to power.
Loyalty was their secret weapon. Do you remember that cliche?
Loyalty was their secret weapon, absolutely. It doesn't feel like that. Can the party come back together?
I think it can. I hope it can. I think it's important for the country. I'm not necessarily sure that's the most popular message to listeners of this podcast, but there's such a fundamental sort of change that needs to happen before that can be a possibility. I mean, the Tories have always been split on Europe. I mean, it's always been a vexed question. I think the Labour Party is almost equally split, but because they're not the governing party at the moment, that hasn't been exposed in quite the same way.
Okay, we'll have to leave that there. Thanks, everyone.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back.
The only thing leaving the EU guarantees is a lost decade for British business, Sajid Javid wrote in 2016. Yesterday, though, he seemed to have changed his mind, promising a decade of renewal. So which is right? The new Chancellor announced a raft of costly measures in yesterday's spending review, declaring that he would create the biggest spending boost in 15 years, putting £13.8 billion into voter-friendly areas like health, schools and policing, calling them the people's priorities. But where's all the money coming from? I'm joined now to discuss that by The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott. Larry, you've watched a lot of budgets and fiscal events and spending reviews.
Far, far too many.
In your time. Where did this one rank?
Well, it was like an old-fashioned Labour budget or mini-budget. I mean, the Javid's right. It was, you know, there was a lot of money being spent there. You know, the biggest cash increase for departments in 15 years. And there was a lot of money floating around, about £13-14 billion of extra spending in the coming year. So that's a sizable boost. It'll boost the economy a bit, and it's a real break with the past.
And what's going on here? Have the Conservatives, you know, completely changed their economic philosophy overnight, decided that austerity's not the way ahead?
Well, they have a bit, but I mean, it's more about winning an election. I mean, it's obviously just a naked attempt to pump up some votes ahead of an election. I mean, they've gone round, looked at all the focus groups, looked at the opinion polls. What do people really care about? Well, apart from Brexit, obviously, what do people really care about? They care about the NHS, they care about schools, they care about law and order. So there's more money for, funnily enough, schools, the NHS, law and order, and a bit more for social care, which is obviously coming fast up on the outside in the list of priorities. So they've hit a load of buttons, and if there's an election, which there probably will be, they'll be able to say, look, we've spent all this money, and they're able to do so because the public finances look better than they did a few years ago. They have a set of fiscal rules to hit, and Hammond, when he left, gave them a bit of leeway, about £15 billion worth of leeway to hit those rules, and they've spent most of it.
Didn't Philip Hammond say when he set aside that headroom or that sort of extra money, it would only be available if we left the EU with a deal? He thought if we had a no-deal Brexit, that cushion would be used up, didn't he?
Sajid Javid's pulled a bit of a fast one here, because what he's done is use the forecasts that were made for the economy by the Office of Budget Responsibility in March in order to justify what he's doing. So the economy has obviously not done as well since March as the OBR thought. They will at some point in the next couple of months come up with some new forecasts at the time of the budget, the full budget. Those will be gloomier than the ones they made in March. And at that point, Sajid Javid is going to have a choice. He either has to retrench or he will have to break his fiscal rules or write some new fiscal rules. And he will write some new fiscal rules. He will say that actually times have changed. Everywhere around the world, there's loads of money piling into bond markets. Long-term interest rates are going down. Therefore, it's quite prudent and sensible for governments to borrow money in those circumstances, particularly with the global economy not doing so well. I mean, this is something that Ed Balls was...
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds very familiar.
It sounds very familiar. It sounds exactly what Ed Balls, Robert Skidelsky, you know, people, left-leaning economists, have been saying for the last 10 years, which is that austerity based around the idea that if you borrowed money, interest rates would soar, was a nonsensical argument in the current world. And, you know, after 10 years, the penny's dropped. The Conservatives have come round to the idea that actually borrowing money when long-term interest rates are as low as they are makes a lot of sense. And that's what he'll do.
How does Labour counter this? It's quite difficult, isn't it? If Jeremy Corbyn is saying, you know, schools and hospitals and so on aren't getting enough money, and Boris Johnson says, don't worry, I'm putting more frontline police officers, I'm going to put money into schools, I'm going to put money into hospitals. It's hard for Labour, isn't it?
It's harder for Labour than it was, because you have to be careful you don't just get caught by saying, well, the Tories are spending X, we'll spend X plus two, or you know, we'll spend X and a half on the NHS. I mean, the fact is that, you know, quite a lot of government departments, even with this spending boost, are nowhere near back to where they were in 2010. I mean, they've rolled back austerity a bit, but they haven't rolled back all of it by any means. But I mean, Labour does need to be slightly careful about just being caught in some sort of bidding war with the government, because, rightly or wrongly, it tends to be that people demand a higher degree of fiscal probity from the Labour Party than they do from the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party can get away with more than the Labour Party can get away with.
Because they have to trust the government to spend the money and not to trash the economy.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that seems to be politically the name of the game. I mean, whether that's right or wrong, that's just the way it is.
Thanks, Larry.
Outside Number 10 on Monday, Boris Johnson insisted that he definitely 100% did not want an election. Honest. "I don't want an election, you don't want an election," he said. 48 hours later, and he was demanding a snap poll on October 15th, only to be rebuffed by Jeremy Corbyn. And this afternoon, Johnson is due to address the nation once more. The Conservative Party are already effectively electioneering. It seems they're treating today as the first day of a campaign, with their social media awash with promises of delivering Brexit and criticisms of Corbyn for more talk, delay and indecision. Is Johnson's confidence in winning an election misplaced, though? On the phone now, we have Professor of Politics at the University of Strathclyde and polling guru, John Curtis. So, John, we look inevitably to be heading towards a general election at some point in the next month or so. Can I ask first, how much difference do you think it makes whether it's held before or after October 31st? Because that's one of the issues Labour is wrestling with at the moment.
First point I guess we should start from, so far as Labour Party is concerned, we should just bear in mind it's at 25% in the opinion polls. It's currently heading for an even worse result so far as the share of the vote's concerned than Michael Foote secured in 1983. So shall we say, other things being equal, it's not entirely obvious that the Labour Party should be running headlong into an early general election. But the potential upside of delaying, and here I think the crucial thing to realise is that the bill that was passed in the House of Commons yesterday and is now going through the Lords, it doesn't rule out no deal. What it does, it says if the Prime Minister wishes to pursue no deal, then he has to get the permission of the House of Commons. And if he fails to get that permission, he has to write for an extension. So it stops no deal being the automatic default, but rather puts in place a procedure whereby the House of Commons can reverse it. And of course, the one thing that the Labour Party, along with all the other opposition parties, knows is that in the current House of Commons, there is a majority against no deal. So they know they can use that clause to make the legislation work to go to the Prime Minister. Now, the question, therefore, is, well, why not allow Mr. Johnson stew in his own juice? Because if indeed he isn't able to negotiate a deal with the European Union, or at least not one that he can get through the House of Commons, and it'll be more difficult to get himself through the House of Commons because MPs will know that no deal is no longer the alternative, and he's forced to fight for an extension. Well, you know what? The Labour Party might just hope that the Conservatives don't do as well as a result. Now, Nigel Farage may well be a considerable beneficiary, but the truth is, at the moment, the Labour Party needs Nigel Farage to take votes off Boris Johnson in order to help make it more likely that they're not going to lose so much. So that's the potential upside, is you basically seriously undermine Boris Johnson's credibility. Here's the man who said, do and die, I'm going to leave on the 31st of October, and he fails to deliver. The potential downside, of course, at least if you agree now to an election in late November, and I think, you know, it has to be set up in such a way that the House is still sitting on the 19th of October. So that takes you to 5 weeks after that. If we are looking at the election that's agreed now for that date, because the potential downside risk is that Boris Johnson does indeed negotiate a deal with the Union, that he does indeed succeed in getting an indicative vote in the House of Commons for people to say they're in favour, and Boris Johnson is able to take the UK out of the European Union on the 31st of October, and you've handed him on the plate an election that Nigel Farage will not compete in, and where Boris Johnson will be able to campaign on, you know, I'm the great person who delivered, who got the UK out of the European Union. Now, you then have to work out basically which do you think, what is the likelihood that you think Boris Johnson is going to get a deal from the European Union he can get through the House of Commons. That's a judgment for the Labour Party to make, but I guess quite a few people might suggest that may not be that serious a risk.
So you think it's understandable if Labour sort of plays it long, as John McBride put it this morning?
I'm utterly understandable. And I mean, if you go for the 15th of October, I mean, apart from the fact that, at the moment, Boris Johnson is in a strong position, and if he manages to squeeze the Brexit Party vote further. He will get a bigger lead. And unless the Labour Party can recover, which essentially means trying to get the Remain back, vote back from the Democrats, and so far Labour Party has made absolutely no progress at all in recovering amongst Remain voters since the debacle of the European Parliament election, that, you know, the honest truth is, in terms of its interest, it's not obvious why you'd want to do that, and that the point is that if you have an election on the 15th of October, and Boris Johnson gets a reasonably comfortable majority, then given also the shakeout that's going on inside the Conservative Party, which now even includes Boris Johnson's brother, and that, you know, the Tory candidates who get elected are going to be almost undoubtedly more pro-Brexit, more pro-no-deal Brexit than is the current Conservative Parliamentary Party, that there is obviously a substantial risk if Boris Johnson wins, that when come the 19th of October, well, he's either already managed to persuade the House of Commons to overturn the legislation, or more likely he'll just manage to win the vote. So if you want the bill of this week to have the intended effect, to be honest, you want Boris Johnson to be having to face the House of Commons on the 19th of October and the current House of Commons on the 19th of October.
And John, how much difference does it make electorally, this sort of purge that he's had, this sense that the moderate Conservatives who might be in some of those seats which were sort of only narrowly pro-Brexit or perhaps Remain, have been chucked over the side?
Well, that I think is a question to which we do not yet know the answer. I mean, what is true is that the loss of support amongst Remainers, which have always been a minority of the Conservative vote, but the loss of the party's vote amongst Remainers did during the course of the Brexit impasse, which, you know, some Remain voters gave up on the Conservative Party, I think partly on the grounds that they can't manage anything, and the Conservative Party has lost around 1 in 10 of its 27 voters to the Liberal Democrats. Some of them almost undoubtedly because they've given up on the Tories on Brexit, but there's still around 18% of Remain voters to say they're going to vote for the Conservatives. And they're almost undoubtedly going to be very heavily, you know, traditional centre-right, economically in particular, Conservatives, but perhaps people who are towards the more socially liberal end of the party. I mean, imagine lots and lots of Rory Stewart, though they've not all necessarily been to Eton. There is an interesting question, obviously, is whether or not some of those people, their loyalty to the Conservative Party, which is perhaps what's keeping them inside the Conservative Party, means that they're no longer willing to stick with it, and whether or not they go to the Democrats. So it would be helpful for the Liberal Democrats, at least, for there to be a few more Philip Lees that they could point to as examples, because I think there is no doubt that the fact that people like Alistair Campbell and Michael Heseltine were indicating that they were not going to vote for their parties during the European Parliament election, we're going to helped provide a catalyst for the dynamics that went on. So yes, I grant you it is. But you know, we should remember that now only 25% of the Conservative vote comes from Remain voters. And at the end of the day, Boris Johnson's strategy from the beginning has basically been to unite the Leave vote. If Boris Johnson can unite the Leave vote, frankly, he can give up on the Remainers. So long as they, particularly if they just go to the Liberal Democrats rather than going to the Labour Party. So I suspect he would probably regard that as a risk worth taking, particularly as compared with the prize that the purge of the Conservative Party would help to ensure that if he does win an election, it's a Conservative Party that will follow him on Brexit.
And will he be a threat to Labour in that case if he doesn't unite that Brexit vote, and if Labour tries to scoop up the Remain vote? You know, are there some kinds of seats that Theresa May tried to target in 2017 and didn't get?
Well, I mean, part of the answer to is this. If you look at the seats which are currently marginal between Labour and the Conservatives, they're a pretty heterogeneous set when it comes to whether or not to how they voted for Leave and Remain. And certainly bear in mind, look, even in constituencies represented by Labour MPs where a majority voted Leave, it does not follow that a majority of Labour voters voted to Leave. Indeed, you know, I've done work in the past that showed quite clearly this is not the case, right? So even Labour MPs and constituencies, you know, they are more dependent on the Remain vote. But you know, at the end of the day, I mean, given our electoral system, I mean, you know, given the country is basically still divided 50-50 between Leave and Remain, given our electoral system is all about who can get most votes rather than who's got 50%, if the Leave votes united and Boris Johnson, let's, for the purpose of argument, has got 50% of the vote, where Leave vote actually at the moment is about 48, and meanwhile the Remain vote is divided evenly between the Labour and Liberal Democrats and they get 26% each, you can work out what's going to happen, right? The Conservatives will win dramatically. So that's the risk that the parties face. But in terms of, you know, particular seats, clearly constituencies which voted more heavily Leave are constituencies where perhaps the Conservatives will advance more. Though do bear in mind that is already quite heavily baked into the baseline of the Conservative vote, because the Conservatives did much better in Leave areas back in 2017. So the question is, how much further do they do? I've done a little bit of playing of what might happen if, you know, you first of all assume a uniform movement, but then you say, well, let's assume that the Conservatives do, you know, 2 or 3 points better in Leave areas, but do 2 or 3 points worse in the most Remain areas and see what impact it has on marginal seats. Probably at the margin advantageous to the Conservatives, but probably no more than that. So just bear in mind, because it's the marginal seats are heterogeneous, what Boris Johnson gains on the swings, he may lose on the roundabouts.
Thanks, John. So one last very unfair question to the panel then. Who's going to win this general election when it comes? Zoe, is Jeremy Corbyn going to storm to Downing Street?
I mean, look, if they do what I think they should do and go revoke, I think he would be a shoo-in. What I think is, if that doesn't happen and you're looking at a Remain alliance, there are 430 seats where no alliance from anybody is going to make any difference. So you're only talking about 150 seats. In 111 of those seats, if the Lib Dems throw themselves behind Labour, the numbers suggest the Lib Dems should throw themselves behind Labour.
They're not going to do that, sorry.
Well, if they were to, I mean, the thing is, you say that, but actually a lot of Lib Dems are very, very serious about this and they're going to be annihilated if they don't. So Jo Swinson makes the noises, but you have to listen to the Lib Dem signal, not the Jo Swinson noise. Because certainly also, don't forget that activists can do things which the leaders told them not to and do things really effectively. So if they do manage to, and I agree with your face for the listener, Heather is yet again looking deeply sceptical. There's a problem with Wales in this scenario, because Plaid really won't throw themselves behind Labour, but there is not necessarily a problem with those 150 seats. So if the Lib Dems deliver the Labour 111 seats and Labour and the Tories combined deliver Lib Dems 40 seats, then we're looking at a progressive alliance with quite a comfortable majority.
So a coalition government?
Yeah, coalition with a comfortable majority.
Jeremy Corbyn is Prime Minister?
Who knows whether Jeremy Corbyn and Jo Swinson could be in coalition. I don't know about that, but...
You're sort of asking a new Lib Dem who's riding the crest of a wave to give up our only point of difference, and
it would rejuvenate the party to have 50 seats rather than 8 or 9. Or
Johnny,
many.
Where are we going to end up?
I think the key question for all of this is which of these two blocks stays consolidated and which fragments. And right now, exactly this vantage point, I don't think we can know. Will the Leave vote unite behind Boris Johnson, or does it split because the Brexit Party have a cause to split on? You know, he gave an extension, he didn't get us out in time or whatever. And on the other side, does Remain unite, cohere behind Labour or someone else? But does it unite behind Labour in the way Zoe is saying? Or does it too fragment because Labour's manifesto is still a little bit Brexity and therefore some go to the Lib Dems and SNP and Greens and all the rest of it? And that, I think, has been changing, not exactly week by week, but that which one is staying consolidated, which is fragmented, has been changing. And it's almost like a game of musical chairs. Where will we be when the music stops? Literally the day of the election, because it can go back and forth. Yeah. So I don't think you can see it, but that to me is the question. Which block stays consolidated, which fragments?
Paul?
I'm pleased that you said I don't know, because I certainly don't know. But I think that your characterisation of where the moving parts are is right. In 2017, we tried to run a campaign which essentially said, if you want to get Brexit done, if you want to strengthen the Prime Minister's hand in Brussels, vote for us. And the supposition that underlied that was, you know, we are going to hoover up some UKIP votes, we're going to get some Labour votes in sort of Midland seats and Northern seats, and that, you know, with the exception of Mansfield, isn't really what happened, because campaigns are unpredictable, right? You know, the austerity message resonated, I think, more than I thought it was going to, and events throw up social care, you know, other things. So I think you're right. Both parties are sort of going to run a version of a core vote campaign. The question is, who can keep most people inside the tent at the point the music stops? To horribly mix the metaphors.
I like this musical
tent. I think we're Glastonbury or something, aren't we? I'm not quite sure. All right, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Jonathan Friedland, Paul Harrison, Zoe Williams, Larry Elliott and John Curtis. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.